Frederick DeBoer is a journalist and the author of The Cult of Smart, How Our Education System Perpetuates Social Injustice. This is Frederick DeBoer. I'm Duncan Gammy. You're listening to Dunk Tank. All right. I'm here with Frederick DeBoer. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
So there's a few things I want to talk to you about besides your book, The Cult of Smart, but I do want to start off with that. First off, why the title? It's very provocative.
Well, I guess I should say right off the bat that the title was the publisher's idea.
Okay.
the core to the conception of the book is that, and maybe the major argument of the book is that our economy and our culture are built to the interests of those who are academically successful, that certainly our labor market, but also in many ways our social structures are set up so that they serve the interests of those who have succeeded at school and who have demonstrated intelligence. The book is a critique of that condition. And so The Cult of Smart just sort of is a snappy way to get across the sense in which there's a cult-like attachment to intelligence as the human virtue that presides all over any other of the many human virtues that we can identify.
And what's interesting in particular about your book, I thought, was that it's not saying, oh, we need to make it so that, all of our schools allow kids to succeed on the basis of intelligence and academic success. Correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like what you're saying is, no, this is the problem is what we're measuring. The intelligence itself is the wrong value to be putting above all others.
Yeah, it just seemed to me like there were several different choices in terms of what you believed about intelligence and human value, and none of them were attractive to me. I mean, one of them is this attitude that's very prevalent in liberal circles that there is no such thing as intelligence, or that what we call intelligence is not measurable in any way, that everybody has the exact same level of academic ability. It's just some people are set up to succeed and some are set up to fail. And that just did not seem to me to reflect my experience either as a researcher, as I was doing a ton of research into educational journals when I was writing my dissertation, but it also wasn't true for me in a decade plus of being a teacher. The other option was to adopt this sort of what I would call this sort of neoliberal school reform logic, which is also everybody has the same potential, but what we are we're lacking school quality, which comes down to teachers and their unions. And if we get tough and enact a few policy changes, then everybody can succeed and we'll see all of our students flourish, which one of the things I say in the book is that not only is that not feasible in terms of what we actually observe in actual educational context, but if everyone flourished, if everyone succeeded in an academic context, the concept of success would have no meaning.
Right.
So it just seemed that to me that there were just a lot of bad options, and I really wanted to take seriously the possibility that we can't actually create educational equality, whatever that means, that every time we've ever observed education in any context throughout human history, there's always been a distribution of ability. There's always been people who do well and people who don't do well in any academic task, in any academic context. And just take that seriously and to say, what if simply presuming that that can be changed is not the way to create social justice? What if rather than continuing to beat our heads against the wall trying to accomplish what has never been accomplished, we start from the presumption that some people are always going to be better at school than other people, that some people are always going to present as more intelligent than other people? And if that's true, how do we ensure the best for everyone? How can we ensure the greatest social good, especially for those who aren't lucky enough to be those who succeed academically?
And one of the things that is interesting here is, I had Chomsky on the podcast at one point, and one of the things he had said is that it's possible that something like intelligence, it could be a potentially lethal mutation where the most successful species on the planet are insects, the least intelligent. And human beings, we have a population of about 7 billion, but that's historically an anomaly. So why do you think, given the fact that there are real reasons to say that not only is intelligence not the highest virtue, but it has given us the means to create our own destruction, you know, nuclear weapons, climate change, et cetera. Why do you think that intelligence is so much more prized and materially rewarded than, say, being compassionate or doing good for your community?
Well, first of all, I think that in general, culture follows economics. And a part of the reason why I think that the smart has deepened has always been preferences for being highly intelligent, and that there's always been rewards for being highly intelligent. But the cultural obsession with performing well in school, to the point where you have things like parents freaking out and working overtime to get their kids into elite preschools that cost $40,000 a year, like that kind of behavior demonstrates how tightly people are grabbing onto this. That is in part motivated by the collapse of the job market for people without college educations, right? Famously, this country had for decades, the factory at the edge of town job, right? Jobs in manufacturing or industry where people, mostly men, who did not have a college education could go to those places, get jobs, work 40-hour work weeks, maybe be in a union, and earn sufficiently to be able to own a home, own a car, put a couple kids through college, whatever. That collapsed in the past 40 to 50 years. For a variety of reasons, automation is probably the biggest reason. Offshoring was probably a big reason, although that's controversial. And so when people look at the economy and they see that the only reliable path to becoming financially secure, obviously some people are professional athletes or singers or whatever, right. But in terms of like moving masses of people and having a reliable path to achieving the good life, the only way that we can see that in our culture is through going to school, through going to college. And so that helps to create the cultural expectation that the only valuable path, the only path that is going to secure a good life for your kids is the path of the mind. And that creates the kind of a feeling among parents where they, you know, which they inevitably will subconsciously sort of signal to their children, you know, your value is equivalent to your performance in school. So I think that's part of it. And look, I mean, I think that intelligence is value neutral in and of itself, right? Intelligence is a tool through which to accomplish certain ends. It's an adaptation in human beings, right? It's an evolutionary adaptation, which has helped us to be more fit in some ways, but it also produces all manner of socially undesirable outcomes. And so the first half of the 20th century was dominated by two wars that showed that the just absolutely immense destructive potential that science had created. And that certainly wasn't a good use of intelligence. Like intelligence is neither good or bad. It's just a tool that can be applied to certain ends. And unfortunately, being the species that we are, that means it's very often going to be applied to bad ends.
And I'm curious though, when you, cause at one point I heard you say that you referred to the Cult of Smart, the book, as a prayer for the untalented. What about the idea that kids who do not perform academically as well, particularly in poor areas, are not necessarily untalented, but that when you have a wealthy family that's getting your kids, you know, doing, you know, extra, you know, work after school, getting them tutors and making sure that they do their homework because they're not out working three jobs and so on. Mm-hmm. is it possible that a lot of kids that we call untalented just are, it would be more accurate to say they're undeveloped?
I mean, look, I don't deny, I would never deny that there are environmental variables that impact educational outcomes. Racial discrimination and class issues, you know, issues of poverty or class inequality absolutely play a role. I have never seen anything that has sufficiently demonstrated why there's so much variation within groups, right? So we can look at different groups and we can find between group variation, right? So notoriously, Black American students underperform white American students. We could call that the racial achievement gap. Many, many theories about why, many fights about how to best address it. People like Barack Obama made it, their policy. What's much more interesting is within group variation. And so you look at, okay, let's chop up the demographic slice as carefully as we can. So let's look at Black 6 and 7 year olds who go to public charter schools in the South Bronx, whose families make between $25,000 and $30,000 a year, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You look at any of those divisions, no matter how fine-tuned you get, you will find students who perform at the very top of the educational distribution and students who perform at the very bottom. Right? In any identifiable demographic slice, you find massive variation. And in fact, the variation within groups is always bigger than the variation between groups. Right. In other words, the gap between Black and white students is not nearly as big as it is between the highest performing Black student and the lowest performing Black student. Right. So it just seems to me that you've got to come up with a really compelling argument for why it is that people who are matched on so many variables perform unequally. And then specifically with questions of, for example, a socioeconomic status and its influence on educational outcomes. Here again, there's no doubt that there is a correlation between educational achievement and economic status, socioeconomic status of the parents. But progressive people tend to massively overplay the size of that correlation. So in SAT results and parents' income, the largest, highest quality study it's ever been done looking at those social economic status and SAT results. We're talking hundreds of thousands of student records, found a correlation between parent income and score at 0.25, so a Pearson R of 0.25. Now is that nothing? No, it's significant, it's meaningful, and it's something that we have to try to address as educational researchers and policymakers and teachers. But that still leaves the vast majority of the variation unaccounted for by that measure, right? You talk to, you know, go on a liberal and lefty Twitter, and they'll just tell you the SAT is just a test of parental income. And that is simply not true, right? Like the data does not bear that out. Socioeconomic status does not come close to explaining all of the variation we have in educational metrics.
Yeah, because certainly intelligence is inherited in large part. I'm not, expert on that, but it is on some level inherited, and probably also the willingness to sit down and practice your SATs for hours on end is probably on some level environmental, but also inherited.
You're right. I mean, there's this five factor personality model, which, there's tons of criticisms of it, and I don't accept it uncritically, but it is a very well-studied construct in terms of behavioral genetics and the relationship between these personality variables and your genetic heritage. And they find that conscientiousness, which is is roughly the same thing as what people call grit, right? And helps to determine things like perseverance and your likelihood to stay on task and to not give up after failure and things like that, that is in fact highly heritable, right? So that's part of the reason why the people for a while, it's fallen out of fashion now, but there was a period of 4 or 5 years where, you know, grit was going to be the solution to everything. And we were going to inculcate grit in our students. And the reality is, not only does grit matter less than we initially thought in terms of educational outcomes, but also grit is not, you know, within the control of students or teachers, right? That there is an intrinsic element to this that, you know, some students have it and some students have less.
And one of the things I wanted to touch on, because you mentioned that you were a teacher, what I believe you taught high school, college. So what was the youngest age group that you taught?
So I did substitute teaching, although never, I did long-term substitute teaching in middle school and high school. Okay. I only did daily substitute teaching at the elementary school level, but I worked as a paraprofessional for a year and a half at a school for kids with severe emotional disorders. And those classes were not single age. They were, I think the youngest student was 8 and the oldest was 12. So that's the youngest that I've taught consistently over a long period of time.
Okay. So I have a few friends now who have gone on to be teachers, and they go in with really, very passionate about the idea of, you know, being a teacher, of enjoying their job and being able to educate young minds. And then they have all this bullshit thrown at them as soon as they get into the system. What was your experience with that like? Not just the cult of smart that we're talking about, but the bureaucracy of the education system.
Yeah, so I mean, I should say up front that because I was in substitute positions or in paraprofessional positions, I didn't have to deal with a lot of, like, I didn't go to the in-services that teachers are frequently contracted to have to attend, which often, I mean, you know, they have a pedagogical sort of, we're going to teach you how to teach this, but they're also really loaded with ideology and propaganda. There are many critiques to be made about traditional education and its relationship to bureaucracy. What I find interesting is that people complain about bureaucracy. The people who complain about bureaucracy and who complain that, you know, teachers are not free to explore and to play and to try new things and to bust out of the old system, those people are often the same people who are pushing for things like the Common Core, right? Mm-hmm. So they're talking out of both sides of their mouth, right? Like if you want innovation and dynamism in the classroom, the last thing you should want is rigid performance standards, rigid assessments, et cetera, right? It's just a sort of direct contradiction in the ideology of the American education system. You can't, you know, teachers can't be free to unleash their creativity and you know, cast off the shackles of the bureaucracy in a situation in which, you know, they have to produce a certain increase in test results every year or else their job can be in jeopardy, right? I mean, people complain about teachers teaching to test, but when you are literally facing termination as a potential outcome of performing poorly, your students performing poorly on tests, you have no choice but to teach the test. It's similar to, you know, there's been plenty of cheating found in both the charter school side and on the public school side. And, you know, people say, oh, how could you do this? How could you fudge the books? How could you mess with the numbers? And the reality is, when you put immense pressure on people to be able to preserve their livelihood based on indicators that they don't control, right? I mean, in a fundamental level, teachers cannot force their students to perform well. In that situation, you're making cheating inevitable, whether that's, you know, socially desirable or not.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of the things I wanted to ask you about on that sort of high pressure environment that you have more and more in schools, where I don't think my parents had to sit down every year like I did, and I'm sure probably you did, where you had to take these like state examinations and they, you know, they evaluate your teachers based on that. And then you have this other phenomenon where a lot of young kids are being given ADD medicine, and some of it is probably legitimate. But a lot of it is just because they can't sit still in school. And you have, you know, 8-year-old kids who there's no way they're, you know, I would think there'd be something wrong if they could sit still for 8 hours on end, you know, in a school environment. Does that worry you at all?
I mean, sure. I mean, you know, early when I started to get into this stuff, you know, there was an obsession with the Japanese educational system and the perception that that it produces, and the Korean educational system, the perceptions that they outperform American counterparts. And they always say, you know, they tend to be taught rigidly to the test, right? They tend to be very regimented, and they go out on these exams and they take exams for hours and hours and they perform well, which is true. But, you know, there's also, at least the last time I looked, far higher rates of adolescent suicide in those cultures than there are in the United States, right? And there's many whistleblowers who over the years have said, you know, we're producing a generation of children who have been forced to evoke a stress response so often in an academic situation that it's causing them to have serious psychological problems. And, you know, I mean, I'm just, again, like, all of this would make more sense if we had really solid evidence that mass standardized assessment actually produces better outcomes. But it's essential to say, based on current evidence, there is no reason to believe that widespread standardized testing improves performance. No reason to believe that. And so we've started this experiment in which is costing teachers their jobs. It's stealing many, many instructional days from the school year. It's causing students to take tests that stress them out and that they don't enjoy and that many of them actively hate. And we're doing it based on really no credible evidence that this is actually going to result in smarter students.
And this, I don't know how you feel about this, but this is something that just occurred to me when you said that places like Japan have such high, you know, rates of adolescent suicide. And it occurred to me that, wow, if they had a gun culture like we have in the United States, there probably would be a lot of school shootings. What do you think? Do you think there's any connection here? Because school shootings have definitely been on the rise in the past few decades. This sort of high pressure and ultra status conscious environment where your grades in large part are your status. Do you think that that plays any role in these killings?
You know, I just don't have any data to say either way. It certainly can't help. But I really don't know. It seems to me, as someone who's a complete amateur on the subject, you know, this school shooting crisis seems to be profoundly multivariate. I think there's a lot going on. I don't know. It's a good question, worth investigating.
Yeah. And one of the things, you know, as these kids go on from high school to college, because I remember in high school, that was the big thing was where you're going to go to college, obviously. But you don't necessarily think we should be pushing kids into college so much.
I mean, so it's a complicated conversation. Right now, there is no alternative that is a surefire way to provide for more people. A lot of people want trade schools to be the answer, but, you know, we're sending too many kids to academic colleges and we're not sending enough to trade school. From my read of the data, just the trades are so multivariate and so different from one to the other. I mean, just to say I'm in the trades doesn't tell you anything. If you look at a list of professions with the highest unemployment rate, the trade, they're littered with the trades. Then again, people say, oh, my uncle owns his own HVAC business and he's doing great. And in fact, many people in the trades are doing great. It's just, it's highly regional. So I'd much rather be a unionized Mason in New York City than a non-unionized Mason in Phoenix, Arizona. It depends on larger cycles of the economy. So the trades are highly vulnerable to the housing cycle. When it's a housing bust, many, many people in the trades wind up out of work. So people want that to be the answer. But I don't have a perfect solution for what to do. I mean, as I say in the book, part of it has to be a direct transfer, a redistributive system that we don't have right now, a social democratic state that takes money from the top and gives it to the bottom. Because the bottom line is, you look at a graph of productivity over time in America, and which is overlaid with a graph of gains to the wages, to median wage, the average work. 40 years, they go up together. They are in tandem. As the economy becomes more productive, workers can make more money. And just about in 1980, they split. And real wage number and smaller number of people are capturing more and more of the gains. And education can't get us out of that problem, right? Like, we can't teach our way out of that situation. Fundamentally, the pie has to get cut up differently, or there's no way that we're going to send a lot of people to systems of economic security. What I would say is, I am in favor of efforts that are underfoot in some places to debundle some of the college experience, so that rather than having one diploma that is the terminal degree, and if you don't have it, if you don't get the diploma, then everything that you've done in college is worthless. But rather to break it down into smaller, discrete skills and ability areas that you can get, whether it's, some people call it a badging system, where you earn a badge for saying, okay, I know how to program in Drupal because I took these three classes and I passed the test. And so I have a badge in that, and I can go to the employer and say, I can code in Drupal for you, even if I never finished the degree. I think I say this line in the book, but the two most tragic words in education are some college, right? Which is what you put down when you don't have the degree, but you did pay the tuition and amass the student loan debt. There are millions and millions of people in this country who are in that position where they can't leverage their college experience for more money on the labor market because they never finished, but they are carrying around staggering amounts of debt.
Yeah, and what's your take on that? Do you think we should cancel student debt?
Yeah, I think we should. I'm just a big lefty, and it is the fact that the United States controls the world's fiat currency, right? And we control the printing press. The federal government cannot run out of money. The federal government is not funded with taxes. The federal government is funded by printing money. It's literally the case. And so it is perfectly easy for the federal government to, sign a bill or whatever for people in the federal government and just make all federally held student loan debt disappear, right? And I think we would argue that this would actually be, for people who want to be justified in these terms, I would argue that this, would help the larger economy as a whole, because part of the problem with our economy right now is a lot of people who are coming out of college as, upwardly mobile young professionals are the kind of people who would traditionally power the housing market, right? Because they'd be graduating and getting a house in which to have a family while they work at their job, but they can't do it because they have $50,000 in student loan debt. Similarly, in the automotive market, there has been some real stalling in terms of overall car sales, and I guarantee you that part of it is you've got this huge chunk of young people who are the kind of people who would traditionally buy cars are now faced with, I got to make my, $450 student loan payment every month, and that's the money that I would be spending on a car, so I can't do it.
Yeah, it's so awful to hear about. I mean, there are some people who are reaching retirement and still paying off student loan debt. It's, yeah. I mean, it's crazy. The thing that you mentioned in there about the government not being funded by taxes, I believe you're touching on what is sometimes called modern monetary theory. My question about that is, why, if that's the case, then why do we even have taxes?
Well, I think the taxes are essential as a leveling system. I think that socioeconomic equality is important. I mean, it's not contrary to high periods of growth. If you look at the 1950s, you had, confiscatory top marginal tax rates. I mean, sometimes they were in excess of 90% at the
right.
top. And that created social equality. There was the Gini coefficient, the typical measure of income inequality in this country was far lower in the 1950s. And yet the 1950s were also the period of arguably history. I think that taxes serve a purpose of making sure everyone contributes in a progressive way, and also constrains people from getting too much at the top. And ideally, you'd like to see social programs that also ensure that people at the bottom are being held up as well.
And some of the tax money, does it act as like a lubricating element for the financing the government, where it's not the primary source of money? Obviously, because you're printing it, but the government would have some, like, if we just stopped collecting taxes entirely, what would happen?
I mean, look, like, the government does take money from people, and it has, a pot of that money, and it does pay for things, and that money is in the, the money that is potentially available to fund things. But the distinction is that the idea that pot is is number one, the only thing we fund with, the deficit myth, the idea that we only have this, have as much as we have tax revenue for, never been true in the history of our country.
Right.
But also that the walls around that are illusory, right? That, the government has a big balance sheet. Sure, tax money is in there, but it's never been close to sufficient to actually fund what we're spending on, even in periods of so-called budget surpluses. And besides, again, like people say, how can that system work? What happens if we get called on our debts or something like that? The point of having the fiat currency is that if the government of the United States was to be considered insolvent, right? I mean, the federal government can't go bankrupt because, again, it can just print more money. But if it was considered to be insolvent, the entire world economy would collapse, right? Like there's no fear of other countries calling us on our debt, as some people say, oh, China's going to call in all its debts. If we did that, the Chinese economy would be utterly destroyed in a moment, So. And we might not control the world's fiat currency for much longer, which is part of the reason why you want to do things like, snapping and having the student loan debt disappear now, because we don't know what the situation is going to be in 100 years. Right. And if there's ever been a time to be spending, it's now, especially in the worldwide emergency.
Absolutely. And part of the reason why I brought up the university angle that you were talking about is because I had read an article that you had written. I believe it's called something like student activism isn't enough. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Was it in the New York Times Magazine?
Yeah, I think it was also in Jacobin, however you say that, where it basically saying that the university shouldn't be the primary site of left organizing. I was just curious what motivated you to write that.
Yeah, I mean, look, I am an academic and have been my entire life. my father was a professor and his father was a professor. There's academics all over my family tree. I've also been a socialist my entire life because my father was a socialist. My mother was a socialist. My grandfather and grandmother on my father's side were socialists, communists, essentially. So I'm speaking as someone who is a part of the system that I'm critiquing. I'm not trying to say that, I'm any different. I have spent most of my professional life in one way or the other in a university setting. Colleges are weird. The college campus is just a profoundly dissimilar space, demographically, discursively, politically, et cetera, from the rest of the world. And things that appear feasible and righteous in that context, on campus, are things that have no application whatsoever outside of campus. And this is a boilerplate, but there's no hope for the left but mass organization of the working class, and can't happen on college campuses. I mean, look, yes, the university is a major employer in the United States, but it's overall a very small sector of the economy, and we've got to be able to reach people who don't speak the language that is spoken on the college campus. And unfortunately, what is standard operating practice in the university now is to speak in a kind of political and theoretical dialect that is completely baffling to most people.
Yes. Yeah. Talk about that a little bit, because I see that even some politicians, like, I like AOC, but sometimes her and the squad sometimes use language where it sounds like a graduate seminar. I'm like, there's no way that this reaches people except for the already converted.
Yeah, I mean, look, any profession and any sort of discursive community like universities have their own lingo and their own sort of set of, I guess, linguistic values, you might say. The problem is that, first of all, in the university, there's traditionally been an association with obscurity, with the profundity, right? Where your language has to be at a certain elevated level in order for it to be considered, seriously academic. So that's part of the problem. But also, this is a much broader problem, on the left, which is what people are motivated to do is to elevate themselves within a particular small social or discursive niche in which they are in, rather than appealing more broadly. So you look at Twitter, lefty Twitter, there is a very strange and particular way of speaking on lefty Twitter that contains many allusions and references and terms that most people won't recognize. But if you speak that language effectively, you will get more likes, you'll get more retweets, you'll get more followers. And so that is the behavior that will be replicated, right? Because behavior that's rewarded is replicated. It doesn't matter that most people, 9 people out of 10, wouldn't be able to follow what you're saying when you're in that space, because there's no reward structure in it for you. The reward structure is within the niche. And that's true on college campuses as well. You become indoctrinated to a certain way of speaking because that indicates your belonging to a particular social order, to a particular social group. And you are rewarded for that by being, a more esteemed member of that group. And in general, human beings will choose to elevate themselves within a smaller group and to receive reward in that group over being more broadly appealing to people writ large, because there's a more explicit reward structure.
Yeah, it's so sad, because I talked to this guy, Sergio Popovich, for this podcast, and he was someone who had helped his student group, had helped overthrow Milosevic dictator. And he now consults around the world with, you know, activist movements like Arab Spring and Occupy Wall Street. He went in and sort of talked to some of them, and he was saying, okay, well, now you have all these millions of people out. Now you need a strategy. Like, well, what is the next step? What are the clear, like, demands you have? So on. And they were saying, well, you know, strategy, like, that's corporate, you know? And then people go, yeah, that's corporate. And it's like, he was describing basically what you're saying, where it feels like once somebody makes this thing, like, oh, I'm too radical even to have a strategy, man. And then people are like, yeah, me too. But it's so self-defeating. How much of that do you think is because, as you say, where the university is the center sort of left-wing activism, mm-hmm. And is, especially at elite universities, definitely wealthier. And perhaps for a lot of those kids, politics is more of an aesthetic.
I mean, look, I think people really understand that when I've gone to college, right? Even today, after years of expansion in enrollments, only about a third of American adults, maybe a third of 40% about there, holds a college degree. What people don't seem to recognize and don't understand is that these elite college spaces, which are so influential, going to those schools is incredibly rare, right? So it's not just going to college at all, it's going to a competitive college in the sense of a college that rejects more applicants than it accepts. When we conceive of college, because our culture is written by people who are academic elites, people think of college as being like the default college experience is getting into a hard college to get into, right? Like that's a big part of the college experience is getting into a competitive school where more students are rejected than are accepted. But the reality is that is an incredibly rare experience, even among when restricted to college graduates. I haven't taken a hard look at these numbers in a long time, but the last time I looked, there was, I believe, like 125 American colleges and universities that rejected more applicants than they accepted. So that's out of, you know, 3,000 plus of these of all schools, right? So we're talking about a tiny percentage. And, you know, sometimes people say things like, you know, oh, I didn't go to an Ivy League school. I went to Middlebury or whatever. And yeah. The response is, do you know how fucking hard it is to get into Middlebury?
Yeah.
Do you know how totally contrary that is to the average college going experience? I mean, a huge portion of American colleges and universities accept basically any student that applies. Right, they have to because they're funded purely by enrollments, by tuition, and so they simply can't afford not to take everybody. And so you're talking about a world that is skews white, although that's changing slowly, but also skews and even more, well-to-do, and they're, you know, even. Even programs like affirmative action programs are not really a bulwark against that. So, you know, Harvard is frequently accused of giving its spots for African American students in its affirmative action program to wealthy Nigerian students, international students, because, you know, for a school like Harvard, the majority of money does not come from tuition. It comes from donations from alums, which feed into a massive endowment, which then provides interest and revenue. And so these spaces are spaces full of people for whom politics has never been material, right? They've never been in a position where, you know, their parents have been desperate, not knowing how they're going to pay rent. They've never been in a position where, you know, in their household, they had to make a choice between healthcare or food, whatever. And so it abstracts everything and it makes everything into an intellectual exercise. And also, you know, the left right now, and I don't mean the radical left, but rather just the broad left, left broadly speaking. If you look at like the priorities of a lot of people who will call themselves activists, there's an obsession with culture to the exclusion of economics. So again, go on lefty Twitter, and every day there's some controversy about how, you know, a movie cast a role that was, you know, Chinese in a book and filled it with a white person, whatever. And, you know, I could agree that that's undesirable. But like the absolute fixation on those issues is, would just seem to be bizarre. I mean, it's just, it's a largely symbolic issue that has no material connection for the vast majority of people. But, you know, it, in a sense, that makes sense because it's comforting, right? When you keep politics in the level of the linguistic, so constantly regulating language, you know, to a tighter and tighter and tighter degree, regulating the culture industries, you know, young adult novels and movies and video games, that keeps politics at that same arm's length that it has been for all of your life because of the privilege that you've enjoyed. And it ensures that you're really engaged to most people.
And that's, you had also written an essay called Planet of Cops, where you talk about people on the left adopting cop-like attitudes of you know, snitching and basically, you know, a lot of behavior you just described. And I'm curious about breaking this down, because on some level, if somebody is truly doing something wrong, they should be, you know, quote unquote, tattled on. Like, obviously, we both agree a Harvey Weinstein needs to be called out. When does it become a quote unquote cop like attitude?
Well, again, we have to look at the reward structure, right? Going against Harvey Weinstein deserves to be rewarded because he is a criminal and a monster and someone who's causing serious social harm. Nobody, I think, disagrees with that. Calling out someone who is a racist, who's in a position of power, who might use that position of power to harm the interests of Black people, I think is righteous because, again, it satisfies a social need. The problem is people reward the snitching behavior. People reward the behavior of policing other people. You get a lot of social reward on a college campus, on Twitter, et cetera. You get a lot of social reward for being someone who calls someone else out. It is considered a very empowering thing to do, and people clearly enjoy it. Again, they get to make a righteous action. The other person is shunned, and their esteem grows. And so what happens is people want to experience that reward. And so rather than, you know, when genuinely harmful situations present themselves and need to be called attention to, you go looking for something new to criticize. Fundamentally, the concept behind Planet of Cops is that it doesn't spring from an organic sort of, I've noticed injustice, so I'm going to call out injustice. It springs from the desire to find an injustice or what I can put, where I can sort of play as an injustice, even if it isn't, in order that I can enjoy that reward. So it puts the cart before the horse, and it turns us into a society of people who are forever looking for any little offense in order to be able to be rewarded for calling it out.
Sorry, were you going to add something there?
No, go on.
What you just said reminded me of a video I had seen of an Uber driver's dash cam, where this guy had one of those Hawaiian luau, like bobble head figures on his dashboard. And this woman in the back, you know, tells him to take it down. And she says, I'll never forget this. She goes, I'm going to put you on Twitter and ruin your life. It's like... It's like, this guy's an Uber driver. He's really not—he's not the bad guy here.
and people like exercising power over other people.
Yeah,
they get off on holding somebody's life in their hands, You know, and again, that is the cop, that is cop behavior. I mean, look, I'm sure that, I've never disagreed that there are individual cops, you know, individual people who are cops who are individually moral beings who want to do good. But that's not the point, right? The point is that systematically, at the level of the system is, among other things, bent completely against the interest of Black people to live their lives. And also, it permits bad cops to escape because the whole system is set up for them not to face any punishment. But anyway, yeah, the cop behavior stems from this desire to exercise power over people the same way a lot of cops get into it, because they want to have that control. They want to be in a position to, you know, come rap on somebody's windshield. They get off on that. They find that attractive. And that is, unfortunately, an attitude that's spreading.
And one of the things, as we're sort of wrapping up here, because we're approaching an hour, and I don't want to take up too much of your time. But one of the things in that essay that you contrasted with beautifully, in my opinion, was sort of, I don't know if you call it the old New York, but a New York that is apparently gone. I don't know. I've never lived there. Where you talk mm-hmm. about people who like they're, you know, you might find them in an AA meeting with a cup of coffee and a cigarette, and, you know, drag queens who are down on their luck, whatever. I can't remember the exact words you used, but people who were truly tolerant in the most complete sense of the word. What was your experience of that world like?
You know, what I'm describing was a period of time in which an assumed virtue of the left was a hesitancy to judge, right? You think you have all these gay people, these trans people, these junkies, these people in interracial relationships when that was still controversial, these radicals, you know, these are people who have spent their entire lives being judged, right? Facing the serial judgment of those around them, their communities, many of whom fled to New York precisely because they believed it would be a place where they were less likely to be judged. So they had a natural resistance to judging others. And there was a really profound equanimity breadth of perspective and humanity in saying, you know, I'm another sinner like you. I'm not in a position to tell you that you're immoral, that you're wrong, that you're a bad person. And that is, not only is that totally gone from the left, it is the complete opposite now, where, you know, tolerance is assumed to only a matter when it comes to things like tolerating other people's race or gender or trans identity or whatever, but it's never perceived to matter when it comes to, you know, saying, oh, someone said something a little stupid, I'm going to let it go, or this person is a bit of an oaf, but they aren't, you know, trying to harm anyone, so I'm not going to call them out. That impulse does not exist anymore on the left.
And why do you think, I mean, can that be resurrected?
Well, I mean, I hope so. I think that, you know, you can't underestimate the way that online life and the very online nature of the contemporary American left has influenced these things. Social media is an accelerator and social trends, including bad ones. And it's depersonalizing. So if I call you out and try to ruin your life, it means less to me because, you know, you're not sitting in front of me. I'm 1,000 miles away. And in general, one of the things that the left needs to do is it desperately needs to get to be less online. You know, because we are a fringe in the American political system, because we don't have a party that represents our interest, it's kind of naturally people gravitated online to find each other so they could say, oh, you know, I'm not alone. I share this with you. But it has had a series of negative effects on the culture of the left, because as I say, you know, social media makes people callous. It inculcates a bunker mentality, an us versus them mentality. It teaches people that that if you're going to criticize or fight with someone, you need to destroy them utterly. That the idea of respectful debate is an anachronism, and it generally forces us to turn inward, to become, you know, to seek more and more and more reward from that sort of small self-contained community, rather than asking ourselves, how can we make ourselves more attractive to the people outside that community?
Well, on that note, Frederick, is there anything you want to, you got coming up, you want to plug or get off your chest?
I don't, not right now.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time. I enjoyed our chat, and have a great rest of your day.
You too.
All righty. Thank you to Frederick DeBoer, and thanks for listening to Dunk Tank. I'm Duncan Gammy. See you next time.